KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Welcome to Friday and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Let's live tweet this show at KUOW so you can get on and talk about it as we talk about the week gone by. So, this week, there is an accusation of blackmail in a Seattle City Council campaign. And it's a strange story. A developer who does business with the city is being sued by former associates of a city council candidate, John Grant. An executive of the development company that's getting sued allegedly told Grant that if Grant would help get the lawsuit dropped, the executive would prevent the company from spending money against Grant's campaign. Did I get that basically right, team?
Exactly.
Okay. So, is this blackmail? And if so, why would you explicitly describe your blackmail plans in a text message to someone who seems to be your political opponent? With us this hour, C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox, Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail, and Paul Guppy from the Washington Policy Center. Joni, you want to start us off? Is this blackmail?
Well, it appears to be quite close in the same exact neighborhood, first cousin of blackmail.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. What's amazing about it, and you touched on this just a second ago here, is who writes this stuff? Who puts this in writing? Technology, and we've seen so many stories like this, you know, nationally and locally, technology can get you if you are stupid about things. And, you know, I'm sure sometime in Seattle history, somebody said to somebody else in a bar, you know, if you do this or don't do that, there may or may not be a committee that's against you. But very few people are ridiculous enough to put that in writing, and we've all seen the texts. And they
not all of us have. We should describe. This is an executive from this developer triad writing to the former mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn, who knows about the city's contract with his company and knows John Grant. Right, C.R. Douglas?
Correct.
What shall maybe I'll just quote the extraordinary
sure. Rock
text.
Rock on here, Bill.
Okay. Yeah. So this is the executive, Brett Allen, from this developer. Hey, Mike, it's Brett. Any luck in getting Grant to a sit-down? I realize 100% of his focus is on election, but nothing else he does today could translate into as many votes. Okay, so that sounds like surely implying a quid pro quo. And then there's this text. Just in case I wasn't clear yesterday, any deal would be contingent on the $200,000 IE, that's independent expenditure, going away. As an alternative, Grant could simply instruct his attorney to accept an offer on the table or make a counteroffer. Deadline is Monday at noon, after which certain bad things can't be undone. Thanks again for your efforts to try to help us both, and go Hawks!
You seem to love reading that.
I really enjoyed that.
Quite a lot.
Honestly.
Well, it wasn't just stupid to put it in emails, Joni said, but it was stupid to just make the offer. I mean, as though John Grant was going to get in bed with Triad. This is his arch enemy. This guy, his whole political career, John Grant, has been to fight for tenants, to fight against developers. He's been fighting Triad for like a decade.
Yeah.
Triad was not going to get John Grant to go away, whether they used emails or not.
Okay, and we'll talk about why the tenants union was against Triad.
It strikes me that this person is thinking, you know, in business, clear communication is very important.
Good, yeah, that's true.
We really need to get.
Let me make it completely explicit in this text and, message that follows.
Not realizing that what he's doing might be illegal. So,
well, let me then. I want to hear more, Paul. But let me defend then this guy, Brett Allen from this developer. If he were to say, we are funding the opponent of John Grant for city council because John Grant is the kind of guy whose tenants union would hound a great developer like us with lawsuits like this. And then, of course, if the lawsuit were to go away, then you'd say, now that's a reasonable person who I will not spend money to defeat at city council. In other words, why is it so necessarily illegal to say, drop your lawsuit and my friends will quit opposing you?
Well, because it's seeking a private benefit in a public election race. So that's the problem. I'm not sure what the law exactly says, but certainly as far as messaging goes, to say, you know, we're trying to make this lawsuit go away and therefore we're supporting one candidate or another in a election campaign.
But isn't that what donors do? You try to get them to do what you want and you...
Can I just say, they don't do that kind of stuff usually in Seattle. This is way out of town, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But the distinction is that when most people support candidates, even big moneyed interests, it's over issues or public policy, not a private business deal and a lawsuit that's causing you an expensive headache. So that's the problem. If they agreed or disagreed with John Grant on a public issue, should we raise taxes? What do we do about the levy? How do we rebuild the waterfront? Something like that. Then it would be very public and it would make sense. But this is a case of trying to get a private advantage from people who are running for public office.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I mean, it may be what seems like a stretch to the average person like you and me, but if they were to say the last thing we need is lawsuit hungry tenants union types, you know what I'm saying? In other words, if they were just out with, I'm just wondering whether is it illegal or is it just seem like doesn't smell good?
Well, I don't know if it's illegal, even what is alleged, basically admitted to. I think it's not just alleged.
Yeah.
They've said they did it and dismissed the employee triad. The interesting thing here is that everyone thinks what happened is wrong. Even Triad thinks what happened is wrong.
They fired the guy.
Even the guy who was fired has admitted that what he did was wrong.
Right.
But... So intuitively, it feels like there must be a law, a rule, something that was just broken.
Yeah.
Is it blackmail? Who knows? My guess is, so far, the county prosecutor, the city prosecutor, no one has sort of taken this up.
Mm-hmm.
Now they may. But if they don't, my guess is you will see, you know, come the new year when the new council's impaneled, some kind of attempt to look at this and say, can we legislate against this? Is there a rule here? Because everyone thinks this is wrong.
Yeah, well, Joni, we have a Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission. It's right in the name, Ethics Elections. Why are they not investigating this?
Well, so far they've said that it doesn't fit in their exact purview, that it's not about campaign financing, to which I would say to Wayne Barnett, the head of it, find a way in, Wayne. Now, the downside of that, of course, is this will take forever. The election will be long gone. And in fairness here, if I can just put in a sentence here, this has nothing to do with John Grant's opponent, Tim Burgess. You know, he's just watching the newspaper every day, another full front page story about his opponent. But anyway, you know, ethics and elections, they have to follow whatever narrow description they have, job, goal, mission.
See, because it's not called the Elections and Ethics and Blackmail Committee. That's
right.
Yeah, there you go. But I mean, obviously, we should figure this out. This sounds so Chicago, so not like Seattle.
New Jersey.
But, you know, but by the time anybody does anything about this darn thing, you know,
it'll be game over on that part.
Why I wouldn't want to have to write the rule that tries to avoid this is, you know, John Grant's a private citizen. He's not an elected official.
Right.
They weren't asking him to commit an act as a public figure.
That's right.
They were asking him to commit an act as a private individual. And for that act, he wasn't going to get a contribution to his campaign.
Right.
He was going to not face a contribution to an independent expenditure campaign. That's pretty tough to figure out how to avoid that.
But wait a minute. One thing about that was
that was such a good explanation by CR. Well,
it really
done.
Was. Yeah. But that was in service to, shall we say, the fact that he is now doing something public. So he's not entirely private. He's in the public realm trying to get elected, and they're trying to say, as you're in that public realm, we won't mess with you if you do X, Y, and Z as you're formerly private.
Again, it intuitively feels wrong.
Right.
Everyone seems like it's wrong, but it's going to be difficult to craft a rule.
Okay, dear listener, in case you don't care yet about all of this intrigue, maybe you care about the fact that there's been a hole in the ground for 7 or 8 years downtown right across the street from City Hall. So can we just briefly explain to people why is there this continuing hole in the ground? Why is there not the $400 million Civic Square project that's been talked about for years?
Well, one reason is Triad, the developer, has not been able to get this thing off the ground. It was negotiated under Mayor McGinn, which I think is why they were trying to pull him in. And the idea was they're going to give them this block, and they will build, I think, a 40 or 50 story skyscraper. And sort of in return for getting the property, they were going to have to create a $25 million plaza, a big public space. So in effect, a big chunk of this block would have been reserved for the mm-hmm. public. That was the benefit, you know, the taxpayers in effect were going to get with partnering on Triad. But they have had trouble getting financing. They've had trouble meeting milestones. So the contract has had to be extended at least a couple different times. And this is what finally frustrated the mayor, who this week said, we're pulling out of the deal with Triad. I mean, this is kind of the last straw.
They're not going to renew the contract at the end of the year.
And the mayor's point was, we are in the biggest building boom mm-hmm. the city's probably ever seen, certainly in several generations. And somehow everyone else has been able to develop every other block in town. Triad, what is going on?
People walk around looking at the skyline yeah. going, look there. There's a spot where there's no yeah. crane.
<That's>
wow.
You not only play slimy politics, you don't seem to be able to do projects. Going somewhere else.
The project actually began under Greg Nichols, but it burbled along under the recession, and that's when Mike McGinn was involved in it. And you can understand that during the recession, there wasn't, hey, there's not going to be that much activity on this because, you know, people doubted us. We're in the opposite phase right now.
Sure, but in the private sector, time is money. When Lincoln Square was built in Bellevue, downtown Bellevue, a number of years ago, the first investors tanked out. They couldn't get the financing. This enormous construction site sat vacant for about a year. And then Kemper Freeman, who's involved in Bellevue, came in and completed the project in a couple of years and turned it around pretty quickly. He probably picked it up for fire sale prices, and that's what got him into it in the first place. But that's what the market does, is it sees these opportunities. This site in downtown Seattle is one of the prime city blocks in the entire country. And so I think being tangled up with the city, the conditions regarding the Civic Square, which I don't think are bad. I think we should have a good public space. But I'm sure there's tremendous complexity about the politics and the rules and the requirements that the city is putting on this project, going back to Mayor Nichols, and that's probably what slowed it down.
There's also an entrance to Sound Transit, so it's a complicated block that you've got to kind of deal with. But listen, there'll be a lot of developers that are chomping at the bit
to take
that contract once it expires.
All right. We've been talking about this accusation of blackmail in a Seattle City Council campaign. Is it illegal? Is it not? Is it going to get investigated by the city? That's not clear at all. We'll keep following it. Right? Okay. Let's leave it there like a hole in the ground. We'll leave it there. Not for 8 years. I promise we'll get
another
back to it.
Another uncompleted project.
Right. KOW's Week in Review, back with some of the top stories of the week. And join us on Facebook, KOW Public Radio. Back in a moment. KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We are recapping, discussing, debating, learning from the top stories of the week. So we were just talking about this accusation of a quid pro quo, at least, in the Seattle City Council race. And we're about to talk about a campaign finance initiative in Seattle. So hanging over this whole thing is, how well are our politics working? So before we talk about this initiative on the ballot, I just want to go around and ask you how, because we made reference to it, like how quid pro quo-y, how blackmail-y, how sleazy are Seattle politics or not?
I think they're pretty squeaky clean. This is a real unusual outlier.
And you're a hard-bitten journalist.
I'm a hard-bitten journalist. The last time we had something that rose to this level was been 10 years, the sort of Rick's strip club, Curlicuccio, stripper gate, where a couple people were indicted and a couple city council members lost. But Seattle has pretty aggressive ethics and elections, department, even though they're not going to jump on this one. And we have quite clean politics. I mean, this doesn't happen much.
Contrary to the weather forecast, this is the Sunshine State, if you think about it. This is a state that loves open government, transparency. Seattle is even more like that. Yes, these kinds of things have happened, but this is very out of character for this city. And that's why it's like a free-for-all. Everybody's jumping on Triad and this guy, Brett Allen, who got tripped up by technology. I mean, we don't do this.
Okay.
Here. So,
all right, two of you are blinding me with the glittery politics of Seattle. Paul Guppy?
So I'll turn down the glare. So as an analyst, I'm always making distinctions, and I think that you're exactly right that, you know, Chicago-style, you know, hardball, old-fashioned, corrupt politics doesn't happen in our city too much, which is a good thing. But we do have to recognize that there are lots of deals, quid pro quos, that happen transparently out in the open because we have very powerful special interests that are entrenched in our city politics. And that I mean downtown interests, developers, labor unions. You know, the teachers union just shut down the schools for a week. So there are very powerful interests involved in our politics. It's just all done above board. Yeah, I wouldn't call it blackmail. I would just call it influence that's in our politics.
And I appreciate that when you talk about powerful interests, you're talking about both downtown business interests and developers and public unions.
Sure.
You know, you're
and
putting them all in that.
Big contractors with the city, and the environmental lobby is very strong in our city, and that all happens above board. We can identify who those are.
Okay. So let's talk about this campaign finance initiative. Part of the premise is we can do it better if we help the public finance some of these campaigns, and they won't be so dependent on fundraising. So this is Initiative 122. And among other things, it would limit campaign contributions from anybody getting city contracts worth $250,000 or more. And also it would create this unusual, I think, this voluntary program for public campaign financing. You would get a $100 voucher that you could then spend on the candidate of your choice. Yeah?
I think it's you get four $25 vouchers.
Yes,
so you can spend that all on one candidate, but you have the chance, in effect, to endow four different candidates.
With your $25 voucher. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, Joni.
Can I just say, can we get off the property tax? Because that's what this is. This is round $5 million on the property tax.
Good point.
Has anybody not noticed that this is
it adds
have
up.
Have a problem? Hit the property tax. It's getting to be a little much.
So are you saying if this were funded some other way, you would be in favor of?
Probably not, because I think it's a solution in search of a problem here. You know, we do have, as CR and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday, we do have district elections that is designed to ramp down some of the spending and the contributions. This is not. We don't need this, and we for sure don't need this property tax.
Let me just put that in perspective, though. Yes, this is the property tax, but this raises $3 million a year. It's very modest. I think it's a latte, a house, something like that, versus the transportation levy, over $1 billion that's going to be raised, you know, over 10 years, over $100 million a year. So, yes, the property tax, but there's a lot bigger bite. Sure. That they're going
yes,
after.
But it piles up, and it's
exactly.
been piling up here,
so
and the city
both.
Is flush. This city is flush, and all they do is send out to the voters, do you want to pay for this?
There is one aspect of this idea that I like, and that is that it's a voucher. So it's a government program that provides a voucher to citizens to spend on the purpose that they support.
And what do you like about vouchers?
The GI Bill is a voucher. Pell Grants are vouchers. Food stamps are vouchers. And in the area of education, I think families should be allowed to have vouchers, especially if their school is failing in their neighborhood. And I think they should have some choice. So as a policy mechanism, it's ironic that in liberal Seattle, this proposal has been made to clean up our elections, and they're using a voucher system in order to put power in the hands of citizens. That's the
so you like it. You say vote yes.
I don't. So I like the mechanism they're using, but I don't like the purpose that they're using it for, and that is taking tax money and using it in politics. And so if Tim Iman came to Seattle and ran for city council, he would be eligible to receive these vouchers. And
wait, I thought you kind of liked Tim Iman.
Not particularly.
No, okay.
But what I'm trying to point out, or let's say Mitt Romney or John Boehner or somebody moved here, Rush Limbaugh moved to Seattle and ran for city council, then tax money that I'm paying, you know, my neighbor is going to take my tax money through the city government and then give it to a candidate that I don't support. And I just think that's unfair.
A couple things. This would do nothing about the conversation we started with this morning, which was Triad and this whole independent expenditure game. That is, by the Constitution of the United States, protected speech that can't be touched.
Because that was a company contributing to an independent right. expenditure, not coordinating with a candidate.
That's free speech.
Thanks, Supreme Court.
There's nothing you can do to regulate that or put limits on that. So this would just deal with direct contributions to candidates. Joni mentioned, and I think it's worth expanding on, one of the big arguments for going to districts was to get big money out of politics so that you would have a smaller geography to run in. You could sort of shoe leather your way to office. And I think what we're seeing in this election is that that is happening.
Yeah,
I mean, Gene Godden, I'm convinced, would have still been in this race had we still had at-large elections. She could sort of live as a name-recognized person citywide. When she had to run in a smaller district, these two upstarts actually were able to sort of shoe leather and knock on doors and kind of, she couldn't leverage her whole name advantage. They are running in many of these districts with a lot less money than they did before. Candidates who would have never survived, probably never run, but never survived in an at-large system. So I'm not convinced that we haven't corrected the problem by the move to districts.
If maybe, there were a problem.
And maybe we should see how it all fleshes out and what the accounting is when this whole election
is
over.
That's a good point, because the Kasama Sawant Pamela Banks race in the Beacon Hill area, South Seattle area, is a fierce competitive local race. You see yard signs everywhere. The candidates are holding events in the community. They're walking the neighborhoods. You see their volunteers out in that area. And it is an on-the-ground campaign that both of them are duking it out in that neighborhood. And that's what the district elections were supposed to create.
Yeah, okay, but the biggest fundraiser in town is the socialist, Shama Sawant.
That's ironic, yes.
So who we haven't heard from is a coordinator or supporter of this initiative. We'll do that in actual news stories on KUOW as opposed to just coming on and explaining things to you. I hear some opinions. Will it pass?
Well, you know, sometimes if an issue doesn't get enough sort of back and forth, and if you read it, it sounds okay, sometimes those babies slide through, even if they maybe shouldn't.
It doesn't do this, but as CR pointed out, but if people interpret it as, quote, taking the money out of politics as a general proposition, people might support that. I don't know. Campaign finance at the national level is not very popular, hasn't gone very far. So if people feel, hey, you're using my tax money to support candidates that I don't agree with, they may vote no and it might fail.
I mean, let me just make it clear. I got concerns about this, but I am not on record either supporting, endorsing, or opposing this measure.
Got it.
But I think if you look to history here in Seattle, we had one of these on the ballot, you know, different version, but public financing a couple years ago, and it went down. Close, but it went down. So the people have spoken on this, so unless they've changed their views, then that's a pretty good guess of where it's going to go.
All right. Our news department will cover this more as it gets closer to your vote. And you're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to come back with more of the top stories of the week momentarily. From Q13 Fox, political analyst C.R. Douglas. From Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter. From the Washington Policy Center, Vice President for Research Paul Guppy, and you figuring out what happened this week and what it means. The University of Washington picked a new president this week, and what's unfamiliar is how familiar she is. The last few UW presidents have come and gone relatively quickly. The new one, Annamari Cause, has been the interim president for about half a year. She's been a Husky for 29 years, and she says she plans to retire here. Joni Balter, the UW needs a good president. What is so great about a loyal president?
Well, loyalty goes a long way. If you think about how, forgive the term, these mercenaries come through here, spend about 2 years here.
That's a good term.
Sorry. Get to know the legislature for, you know, a session or two, and then get the old wandering eye out to see what's the next best job to double their salary. I personally would rather have Annamari, how do you say her last name?
Cause.
Cause.
Because
Cuban. She's very, very admired at every level within the university. She's not in, I mean, she's into the salary like anybody else is, but that's not her thing. Her thing is running an institution she loves. She doesn't have a wandering eye. She's not out there looking for the next job. That takes a lot of time and effort away from the big job of managing this amazing institution in our midst.
Everybody agree, long loyalty is an important criterion here?
Well, institutional stability and leadership is very important for any organization. Seattle University has had the same president for over 20 years, I think. And so the ability to maintain a strong vision at the top and move an organization forward is very important instead of the churning. And we've seen that with the superintendent position at Seattle School Districts. They have a crisis in leadership, constant turnover there. What I would look for from the president of the UW is some at least talking or initiative to reduce the cost of going to school there. So,
which the legislature did.
They've been
time
doing
around.
That, and so it would be great to see a university administration also join on board and say, we're going to do what we can to lower the cost of attending the university. I think that'd be a great initiative.
I think the Board of Regents finally got it right. I mean, bringing in outside stars has not worked. And by choosing someone who's basically spent her entire adult career here, you do have that loyalty. And the loyalty is important for two reasons. One is you're going to encounter hard times. This is a tough job. You're inevitably going to get in some fight with the legislature, probably with the faculty, probably with the students. I mean, there's always some fire you're putting out. And if you don't have a loyalty to the institution, when the goings get tough, you leave. I mean, Mark Emmert left in a big huff about the state legislature. So you don't have the stick-to-itness, the desire to stay with it when going gets tough, and I'm telling you it will get tough. On the other side, when the going gets good, and
you'll
that'll
get
happen too, you'll get headhunted. And you'll get all temptations and all kinds of offers and all kinds of money. If you're loyal to the institution, you actually want to ride out your success here, build on it. The best university presidents here have been in, you know, the last 50 years, more than that, were Bill Gerberding and Charles Odegaard, each who served 15, 16 years. This Seattle U president, 20 years. You can make your mark. It's very hard to do that. Sundberg and then William Sullivan before that was probably 50 years.
I will point out that Bill Gerberding was from out of state and stayed here 16 years. They hired Lee Huntsman in 2003, who was a longtime Husky, and he lasted 1 year. But she seems like she really wants to stay.
She's all about the University of Washington. She's already accomplished some things. I know I'm going to get this pronunciation wrong, so bear with me. But look at sort of the interesting thing that came out this spring. While the UW was in all this turmoil, what comes out? This interesting partnership with Microsoft and the university in China. Somebody help me. Tsinghua University.
I'm a little rusty on my Chinese right now.
That is not necessarily close. But so all this kind of cool future entrepreneurial, just like Mike Young, her predecessor, did, while she's supposedly not even the president. She was the interim president. I mean, this person is committed to this university, and we're darn lucky to have her.
Yeah, and then maybe to add to that is that about longevity is that the University of Washington is an enormous institution. It's bureaucratic. My dad was in the academics for his career, and as most people know, campus politics, I mean, forget about Washington, D.C. It can be incredibly rough. And to not be lame ducked, when bureaucracies recognize that this person is not going anywhere, we're not going to outlast them. So we're just going to have to come to some kind of settlement that creates a stronger institution.
And the most important relationship you have as university president is not with your board of trustees. Actually, at the end of the day, it's with the state legislature. I mean, they ultimately are your funders in some ways, are your board of trustees. And the last three presidents have had pretty bad relationships down there. They're going to respect her. They're going to respect the fact that she's not some big high-paid star, that she paid her dues through this institution. That's going to go a long way with state lawmakers.
Well, then why isn't she going to be a high-paid star? I mean, the last guy came in at what? Michael Young came in at $500,000 and left at $853,000. Are they going to pay her a lot less than him?
I don't think that. Well, they actually paid Mike Young less than they paid Emmert as he was leaving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she'll probably be, I don't know, $600,000-$700,000 range. I mean, no, it's not going to be ludicrous. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be, you know, Emmert left at almost $1 million.
Mm. Why do women always get paid less?
They will give her a decent, reasonable salary that's commensurate with probably what Young was. But I just think her whole shtick, her whole personality, her whole loyal to the institution is going to play very well in Olympia.
Not sure she calls it a shtick. Yes, her persona. But Joni, were you serious about, do you think she gets paid any less?
I don't actually know what her salary is. Does anyone here know what
her salary is? I don't think they've worked it out.
I don't think
but it's more than the governor.
But,
so,
right,
much more.
Right. But
yeah,
here's the thing.
You know,
it's a I hope they pay her you know, every dime she's worth, and that it not be like, you know, what I just joked about a couple minutes ago, that women always get paid less. I hope she gets exactly what the male president would get. But that said, she's not about the money. She's about sort of loving this institution. She has so much support from alumni, students, faculty. I mean, it's a resounding.
We're about to sing the Husky fight song here. Maybe we'll do that while we take a little break. I know it involves it being difficult to go through the Dardanelles, but I'm a little vague. I'll have to Google that.
Look it up. It's from the wars.
Yeah. KUOW's Week in Review. More of the top stories of the week coming up. KUOW's Week in Review. We're tweeting this in real time at KUOW and Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke. You did it, kayaktivists. You chased Royal Dutch Shell out of Elliott Bay. This week, Shell said it will not send its oil rig and support ships to Seattle again for servicing. Instead, it will send them to Everett and Port Angeles. Paul Guppy, what difference does it make where they go?
Well, there goes hundreds of well-paying jobs, that's for sure. So, actually,
they're going to our friends in Everett and Port Angeles.
Well, good for them. It just belies, I think, Seattle's history as being kind of a muscular, industrial, blue-collar type city where the port was a very important part. And I think historically, a couple of decades ago, city leaders would have been united in saying, we need to secure this business. It's like the container terminal. It's like the railroads that operate through Seattle. It just brings good-paying family jobs here. It also indicates a split between traditional blue-collar unions and environmentalists when it comes to these kinds of economic projects. So I personally think it's too bad that, you know, our port lost the business, and there's a certain number of union-based family wage jobs. These are really good-paying jobs are going to go to another community.
But not all union jobs are tied to climate change and fouled coastlines.
No, they're not. But it's just, you know, a business deal that came along. It was a customer, a corporation that would have paid to use our port. And at least for this season, they're not going to. And I think that's too bad.
But you're rhapsodizing about something that actually didn't happen. Shell didn't find the oil at a reasonable price. The world oil market is not good. So,
yeah,
you know,
okay,
for now,
that's their problem. My point
right,
is they need
they weren't going to do any huge big
but they
business
have to put the oil rigs.
It didn't work. They're out of here.
Okay,
so they just have a choice where to stop on the way down from a mission that didn't work. And so I don't blame them. They didn't pick Seattle because that wasn't going to work. There'll be some protests at Port Angeles.
So we lost the business. I mean, whatever Shell
year.
Is doing, they're doing a project. If maybe it failed for
yeah,
them
but you're saying it's sort of out of context, like because this was going to be an ongoing thing at least for a couple years, but they didn't find what they were looking for.
The oil rig went somewhere, and that was work that could have come to Seattle and didn't.
It probably will be better for Port Angeles than it ever would have been for Seattle. I mean, it really moves the needle. You know,
there.
These kind of jobs in a much smaller community.
Sure.
I think it was up there for a month before it came to Seattle in April or so. And there was like $1 million contribution to the local economy with hotel stays, with the guys and girls doing the maintenance on the boat and, you know, the meals and all that kind of stuff. So they are open arms welcoming. You know, they'll be kayaktivists, but the political establishment up there wants this. And I'm sure Shell said, listen, why don't we go where the welcome mat is much better than in Seattle? Even though they kind of won all these hearing examiner lawsuits and all the rest, you know, you're one new regulation away from another hassle if you come back to Seattle.
There you go, Joni. I mean, he's saying the jobs matter. CR is also saying the jobs matter whether there's oil under the Chukchi or not.
I'm happy to have said what I've said.
Okay. what do you think the welcome mat, you said welcome mat, what's it going to be like in Everett and Port Angeles? I mean, it's not that far. You just have to burn some, just drive your electric vehicle up a little bit farther and you can protest that too.
Listen, there were oil-based kayak, right?
Yes.
There were kayaktivists in both places. I think it's a bit more of a commute. And I think, to be honest, I feel like...
Isn't it worth
it? I think the kayaktivists probably feel like the battle has been won.
Right.
So I don't think they're going to be nearly as aggressive with this thing because it's not heading back to the Arctic.
They don't look out over the harbor and see it right there in Seattle, so they probably feel that's an improvement.
Oh, but true. They're not headed up there to drill, baby, drill.
They're not going anywhere.
They'd probably have to stop off at a gas station that had like a sticker saying, don't fill your tank. You know, that the whole problem there.
Mm-hmm. Right. KUOW's Week in Review. That's Joni Balter and Paul Guppy and C.R. Douglas. And we are going to get right back at the top stories of the week. We got a couple more to go. Don't go away. KUOW's Week in Review, recapping the top stories of the week and getting your input on Twitter right now. I told you we're live tweeting at KUOW, and we have an interesting comment, a good point from Rebecca, who tweets, no mention of Anamari. We were talking about the new UW president. And Rebecca says, no mention of Anamari being the first UW woman, Latina, and out gay president? 2 question marks? So
that was a mention right there, and a good one.
Well, there was a mention. But, you know, I don't know. Is that a good thing that it wasn't even that newsworthy when we're talking about the leadership of the University of Washington?
I think, you know, in some way it's a sign of progress, I guess, that we didn't feel like we needed to mention all that. But I do think it does help kind of reinforce her loyalty. I mean, I think that she was elevated by this board, was an endorsement of diversity, and I think it's further going to cement her relationship with this university. So it really, I think, will play into my larger point, which is she's really going to be here for the long haul, I would expect.
And I think it's important for introducing who she is, and just so people understand a little bit about her. But fundamentally, what's important is her leadership qualities and how she runs the university. We just hosted an event with Susan Martinez from New Mexico. She's the first woman Latina elected governor in the United States. And while that was mentioned in her introduction, she spoke for the better part of an hour about reforms in New Mexico and education reform and said nothing about her ethnic background. So it's just a way of identifying who the person is, but then what people are really interested is, what's your program, what are your ideas, and that's what's important.
Well, you know, the search firm and the Regents, they looked at a lot of candidates all over the country, and this happens, sadly, every single time that we're replacing a University of Washington president, because it happens too frequently. But look at that. She, for all her descriptions, surpassed everybody. She was right in front of their face. She was the right pick, and these are the details of her. And this place is kind of shrugging and saying, "Yeah, right. You're our person."
Thanks for the input, Rebecca. Twitter at KUOW. Let's continue on some of the big stories this week. As of right now, this morning, we are waiting for Republican U.S. Congressman Dave Reichert to tell us whether he's going to run for governor against Jay Inslee. Unless you're listening to the podcast of this show or the evening repeat of this show, in which case you know more than we do, because we really don't know. Do we think he will run? Paul Guppy, you conservatives all know each other.
That's right.
You all speak for each other.
You make
Come
it
on.
Sound like we can all meet in one room.
Right.
But in Seattle, you can.
Yeah, that's actually true. But actually, I'll follow up on that. There is for years, there has been buzz, as you would expect, among official Republican circles. So that would be the party, which we're not so tied into. But beyond that, there's the kind of larger conservatives, Eastern Washington, always looking for after Dino Rossi, who is our great candidate, superstar, who can step forward. And Reichert has been mentioned regularly. He wins, and his district is better now, but previously he had closer elections and managed to pull out victories each time. He's got a great resume in law enforcement, In Congress, he's been working on international security and terrorism and national security issues. But he's just a great, attractive candidate. And I think Republicans have been trying to woo him for many cycles. And this is the closest he's come to saying yes. Now, he still may be coy and turn it down, but we'll have to see.
Friday is the punchline here. Mm-hmm. He's announcing on a Friday. That sounds like I'm not running. Because you announce on Monday and ride the whole week of news. So this sounds like a no, and I just want to add that
You'll leave it to a reporter to explain that.
Yeah. So Republicans have been wooing Reichert, and Reichert has been talking about this over and over the years. He really wants to run, but, you know, everyone has to look at the election. It's called 2016. It is tough for a Republican in this state.
In a presidential
year, it is very difficult. So he is...
Explain that.
Okay, so...
it's not complicated. No, just briefly, like...
Here
you
know, we go.
So everybody doesn't know the turnout...
Who's in the electorate in a presidential year? It's far more Democratic of a turnout.
Right.
It's far more young people, far more minorities.
Larger turnout, too.
Yeah. It's a larger turnout overall. So when you get to something like the 2014 election, mm-hmm. it's narrower. It was a more Republican turnout, and that's what happened.
So you're saying he won't run because he thinks he'll lose?
Well, they all do that calculation. You have to put yourself, you know, body and soul into this, and then you don't do that so that you can get to the end and say, it was a presidential year.
And
that
he doesn't get a free pass. He's in the House of Representatives, so he has to run for re-election every 2 years. If he runs for governor, he can't run for the House at the same time. Mm. So he has to give up his congressional career in order to do this. He has quite a bit of seniority on committees there, and there are a lot of House members. Of course, every House member is a senator in waiting.
We're being very politicsy here. I do want to get to some sort of bigger issues here, but CR, I haven't heard from you.
Well, I feel like it's now or never for Reichert. He's been talking about running for several cycles. He's 65 years old. If he doesn't do it now, I feel like the window probably closes. He's close to 70 in 2020. A new batch of Republicans will sort of be up and coming. If he does jump in, I think Joni's right. It's a tough race. You know, what's dogged Republicans in this office for 30 years, certainly the last several election cycles, is they get tripped up on social issues. And there's kind of a litmus test blue Washington likes candidates to fulfill. They want you to be pro-choice. Now they want you to be for gay marriage. You probably need to be for Obamacare. You know, before you even get to sort of fiscal issues, Republicans would do well in fiscal issues if they could ever get to them. But the problem is the candidates for statewide office have been tripped up in social issues. Reichert's pro-choice. Reichert has been against gay marriage. Reichert wants to repeal Obamacare. I mean, it's going to be tough for him to talk about an economic message, which I think would resonate. You know, we like Tim Iman's initiatives. We don't want income taxes. You know, Republicans would sort of play there if they could get to that, but the last several Republicans haven't. Not McKenna, not Rossi, not Craswell. They all get tripped up in social issues.
You know, Reichert has some street cred on environmental issues. That's something he has worked on that does, you know, obviously resonate in the great state of Washington. But he also...
He voted for a cap and trade.
And he voted to expand the wilderness area.
That is exactly right. But he also hasn't really... in some ways separated himself enough from some of the hard right in the Republican Party. For example, he voted to shut down the government. So you can kind of see that ad just coming out. Wow. Dave Reichert voted to shut down the government. I mean,
more like Dave Reichert voted to shut down the government.
That's good.
Come on, Dave.
Is that your after
really,
hours?
Really, Dave? Shut down the government.
That's is that your after hours joke?
That was my negative ad campaign.
Sounds like he writes the ads.
I'm thinking you do that like, you know, when you're done here.
But, yeah. But you know, if he gets in, he goes to the top immediately.
Yeah, that's right.
The race is actually kind of cleared this year. You have one guy in, Bill Bryan, a port commissioner, certainly not nearly as well known as Reichert if he jumps in. A lot of the people that were thought, you know, was McKenna going to do it? No. Andy Hill was the new star. He was going to be the guy that was going to do it. He isn't going to do it. So the field is open for Reichert, and there's a lot going for him. This guy caught the Green River Killer. In a lot of ways, he's been above politics. He does have a, you know, pretty good green record. You know, I think the social issues are going to be tough for him. But listen, this guy's a player the minute he decides if he wants to.
Exactly. And he would also, for those reasons, there would be tremendous enthusiasm on the conservative side among donors and fundraisers. And so raising money would not be a problem for him.
Okay. Everybody listening to the podcast and the repeat of the show knows the answer. What's the answer? Does he run or not today? Joni, well, you said no already.
I would have said that he was likely to do it, but he picked Friday. So that's throwing me.
A Friday no.
Based on his experience, he likes to flirt with these, but then he declines, and yeah. I think that'll be the same. And,
a flirt. Flirty, no.
I have to agree with that. However, it would be nice if he ran because it would create a genuine competitive race with a real choice between Inslee and a strong Republican. But I think that's right. He's flirted with this, and I think he's likely to say no.
Paul, do you think Rob McKenna is still potential?
Not this cycle, certainly not.
Yeah, why not Rob McKenna?
Well, it's like the day after the election, he said, "I'm not running again."
Oh, that, no,
that means exactly what?
Well, exactly. So nobody believed
him. Also known
him.
As nothing, right?
Right. Nobody believed him. But as the years have gone by, he has stuck with that very strongly, and he's doing well in his law practice right now.
He could come charging in January.
Okay, pundits, one more top story this week to understand in a moment on the Week in Review. KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox, Joni Balter of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Paul Guppy at the Washington Policy Center, a free markety think tank exactly. Here in Seattle. Now, we have been following some umbrage, some outrage, actually even nationwide, the upset in Seattle has been followed because some Seattle parents were angry this week because the school district is reassigning some teachers. The district says that fewer students enrolled than were projected, so they're able to take some teachers away from where they're now needed less and move them to schools that had been having to hire substitutes. They're redeploying them. Okay, now, perfect example of the debate here is on our Facebook page, KOW Public Radio, where Nicole says, "I can't believe it is considered normal in Seattle for the district to yank teachers out 5 weeks into the school year and move kids into different classrooms." Okay. Susan writes, "This happens every year. It's called balancing. Projections for enrollment were wrong. Shuffling teachers is fiscally responsible." C.R. Douglas, who's right?
Well, I think the first person's right. It does happen every year to some extent, not to this extent. We're talking about 25 teachers or so, and it doesn't happen this late. Usually happens week one or even before school starts. So this is unusual this year. The whole reason is that with less student enrollment comes less money. So the district will have $4 million less from the state than it thought it would just a month or so ago. So how do you kind of make that up? Now, the district hasn't been totally clear about what exactly they're doing here. But one thing that has been talked about is taking these teachers who are now sort of in under-enrolled schools and, as you say, moving them to over-enrolled schools. Schools that have been over-enrolled for quite a while. They were over-enrolled last year, last spring. They're still over-enrolled despite the current downturn when this school year started. So they've been using some semi-permanent subs, if you will, to kind of get them through. So move teachers over there, relieve subs. It saves you some money.
But isn't that the right thing to do? I mean, are we just talking about that they should have had better, more accurate projections than they did?
Which is impossible.
Which is impossible.
Yeah. So you have to realize each student comes with money attached. So that's how you get up to these numbers.
Yeah.
So the district had something like 650 fewer students than they projected. So you can say lousy projections. That's probably true. But also they're citing this. I don't know if this is true. But they're saying the strike had some students going north and south once it started dragging on. But nonetheless, this does happen every year. You have to sort of figure out the actual real number of students. Now, I don't want to sit and defend this because I don't want to defend this because it's so upsetting if you're a parent in the school district. You know, all of us who've
Paul's raising his hand.
I'm raising my hand because if you've got a couple kids through the Seattle schools, which I did, at the end of it, you're like, hey, where's my trophy for navigating the school?
But I'm trying to get, is this just about that you should have been more accurate, or is this really about we think that you're not spending enough on teachers?
Well, what parents are saying is, listen, we get that you have less money. We get that the sort of, you know, we're not faulting you necessarily that 600 kids didn't show up. But a month into it is not the time to make this change. And there are other ways. I mean,
what's the big deal about changing a teacher a month in?
Because students bond very quickly with a teacher. Parents bond very quickly with a teacher.
And with each other as a group.
And so
when you put third graders together, you don't want to disrupt it right when the school year starts.
So parents are saying, listen, find the money somewhere else. Central administration, your budget went up 16%. You still got reserves in the budget. I mean, can't you figure out $4 million, you know, piecemeal that together to just keep this school year what it is? And if you have to sort of, you know, reconfigure next summer, do it then.
Yeah. So the reason I say this is a deeper indication or symptom of the problem is that this is what bureaucratic central planning looks like. And that's how public education operates in big cities like Seattle. So charter schools are not disrupted this way. That's why they're popular. Private schools, Catholic schools don't shift teachers around. And that's because decisions about teacher assignments are made in the school building by the principal.
But this is a big district, don't they? Isn't it make sense to move resources from this school inside the district to this school?
But that's the problem, is that they're dealing with it as a gigantic government bureaucratic unit, and that leaves the parents out. That's where the frustration comes in. And again, I'm a public school parent, so they have so little influence over who your kid's teacher is and changing the assignments, that's where the frustration comes.
The problem is they're doing it late. Why not do it the day before school starts, not a month after?
Because that's not when the students showed up. So that's the problem. But I will say, if they're paying so much more to central administration, how about this crazy idea? Get a better demographer.
They have been very bad at predicting enrollment. That's true. But they knew these numbers. I mean, people start registering and enrolling over the summer. So it didn't just happen, you know, September 8th.
Again,
they have 600 fewer.
Is it really so hard on a kid that your teacher, you had one teacher, kid, now you have a different teacher. That's life.
Well,
it's disruptive to kids, especially.
Look at all the blowback
kids
you're getting from parents.
And it's upsetting to parents. They just feel so helpless with this faceless bureaucratic system that simply announces what's going to be happening with your kid without any input or decision on the part of parents. And families are just struggling to get by. They understand that the district has problems with budget, not getting enough money from the state. But, you know, I'm just trying to get my kids through the day, get them to school on time, get them an education. And that's where parents get frustrated, that they're just the passive recipients of decisions that are announced by the central district.
Listen, it's time to go because it's the end of our. Don't blame producer Jason Pagano or social media producer Bon Huberman or our engineer Jack Walters. Just blame the clock. And don't blame C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox or Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail, or certainly not Paul Guppy from the Washington Policy Center. It's just we only have so much time to discuss the news of the week, and we've done that. And I learned a lot. I enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's do this again next Friday. The Week in Review on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.